This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 133, where today we're going to interview JD Trask, CEO of Raygun, talking about application performance and monitoring, recorded live Wednesday, June 8th, 2016. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Microsoft Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, and the competitive landscape and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
Send us a tweet either to the show at MS Cloud Show or to Andrew at Andrew Connell.
Or Chris at LoungeFlyZ.
As we'd love to connect with you. We're just two dudes telling you how we see it. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid NL. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, Business Intelligence and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on valid.nl. Hey, CJ, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. How about yourself?
Man, I feel like we've just done about 15 minutes of tongue twisters.
Yeah, we re-recorded our show intros, right? And it took a few attempts.
Man, the word excerpt, it's funny what trips each one of us up. The word excerpt trips one of us up, and and I just blanked on what messed me up. But man, we just, that was a hell of a lot of fun.
Super painful.
Yeah. Hey, so we were actually responding to our listener question from Tom Reising that we played last week in episode 132, where he didn't do it intentionally, but I think that we did it ourselves. We called ourselves out for having very old recorded and dated show intros and outros. We finally got around to redoing those, and they'll be in this episode this time. So, ta-da.
Yeah, it was definitely about time.
Yeah. So, hey, man, we're going to keep this one short because you had a really good interview here. But what have you been up to in the last week here? What's new with you?
Well, I had a super important strategy meeting on a boat yesterday. It was fascinating. No, it's been lovely up here. We took the team out on a boat yesterday, bobbed around in the middle of Lake Washington here up in sunny Seattle, and talked about our progress and had a bit of team bonding, and it was awesome fun. It was really nice. Beautiful sunny day.
Awesome. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, we had the exact opposite in the last few days. We dealt with tropical storm Colin, which blazed over the peninsula part of Florida from the Gulf of Mexico. And I think from Sunday night, this would have been, what is that now for our listeners? That would have been Sunday night, June the 5th through, Tuesday morning, June the 7th. We got slammed with a boatload of torrential rain and wind and everything, which it's not that big of a deal for people who are used to it. I mean, we basically just didn't go outside. The poor dog, waiting for like the break in the bands to be able to run out and go take a leak or whatever. But as long as you were home and you didn't have to go outside, everything was fine. It was just kind of cool to watch everything. And I got a reminder to turn the irrigation sprinklers back on sometime tomorrow. So make sure those were off for a few days.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, that sounds, I'm glad you dodged something more serious. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess the other big thing was I've been working like crazy. I'm trying to knock out a couple projects so I can move on to a project that I've been looking forward to getting back on that I will talk more about on the show in the next, sometime in the future, that just to kind of share with people what's going on there. But it'll be something really cool. I want to make sure that I've got some stuff to share when there's actually something to actually, or something to talk about when there's actually something to share and people can go take a look at. But it's a major, major milestone for me that I was able to lock out yesterday and just on top of the world right now, man.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
Good progress.
So, hey, you sat down today and did an interview with the CEO of Raygun.io. So what can you tell us about this? This is one I've been really looking forward to.
Yeah. So I think I had Raygun as one of my picks a couple of shows ago. I can't remember exactly which show it was, but yeah, we thought we'd get them on the show and talk about what they do. And JD is a friend of mine. JD Trask is their CEO. And he's a good friend of mine and a fellow Kiwi. We used to live together, not together, obviously, but in the same city in Wellington in New Zealand, and have worked for the same company in the past. So that's kind of how I know JD. But they have been on an interesting journey for a number of years. They started a business called Mindscape, which made developer tools and libraries and things for .NET developers. And probably their most prominent one was an object relational mapper, an ORM tool called Lightspeed, so from Mindscape. But more recently, they'd built a crash reporting and analytics product, and then a user performance monitoring and analytics product under the banner of Raygun. And in fact, they've rebranded their entire company as Raygun. And so I sat down with him and talked to him about their journey, talked to him about their products, obviously, and what they do and who they're for, and a little bit interesting tidbits on how they've built them. They're currently on AWS, and we've got some interesting news around that in the show, or in the interview, I should say, about a potential move in the future. So that was really interesting. They built quite a heterogeneous environment. So they've got some Node in there. They've got .NET Core coming along. They've got some container work they're doing, or looking at, I should say. They've got a bunch of Postgres and MySQL and Rabbit MQ and all sorts of things. So I thought it was really interesting from the .NET developers at heart. They've built this service that runs at quite large scale with tons and tons of data. We sat down and talked about how that stuff runs for them and their transition to a SaaS business in the cloud. So it was fascinating.
Awesome. Well, hey, without further ado, why don't we just dive into it?
Sounds good.
Cool. So here we go.
All right. Well, welcome, JD, to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks very much for coming along. A lot of our listeners are in the dev space, and so are no doubt familiar with Raygun. But why don't we kick things off with a little bit of background about yourself and Raygun, just for those unfamiliar.
Yeah, sure. So my background, obviously, I sound a little bit different, kind of like you.
See, a little.
So I'm from Wellington, New Zealand. That's where Raygun's headquartered. And we built a company, we were originally called Mindscape, and we built a range of .NET tools. And then in 2013, we built a software crash reporting product called Raygun. And it's just gone great guns for us. So it supports about 20, 25 different languages and platforms, .NET being a core one of those, but also JavaScript, iOS, the Xamarin stack, Node, you know, everything. And so that really took off for us. And then we, late last year in 2015, we also launched a real user monitoring product, so monitoring the performance of things. We've just put out a beta of the real user monitoring for native mobile apps, so both the iOS, Android, Xamarin suites.
Nice.
So we're keeping pretty busy in that sort of DevOps-y, just tools that we wished we'd always had and that we'd built up. And so I'm the co-founder and CEO of the company, and I come from a long history of writing code myself, but I don't quite write as much anymore as I would like.
But, it happens to the best of us, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. So Raygun came out of Mindscape. How long ago was that? I remember Raygun launching a while back, but it sounds like you guys are sort of focusing heavily on the Raygun side now. Do you still make your older Mindscape products?
Yeah, so we launched Raygun in early 2013, and within about 2-3 months, we really noticed that the growth trajectory of that product was just much, much stronger than what we'd experienced previously. We still have the other products. We use them extensively ourselves, especially the Lightspeed product is actually baked into the core of the Raygun platform. So Raygun's cloud hosted. So the bulk of the app is hosted on servers with us, and then there's a little piece of code that our customers put in depending on platform. But back to the question, we still sell those, but Raygun really is the focus, and that's partly just in pure business terms. It dwarfs everything else now, to the point where last year we rebranded the company from Mindscape to Raygun because people were starting to say, why do I keep seeing this Mindscape on our credit card statement? You know, I only know of Raygun.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and Raygun also shifted from being a crash reporting product to the brand, and now we've got Raygun Crash Reporting, Raygun Pulse, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so why don't we dive into a little bit about your two different primary products now, the crash analytics product or the reporting product and Pulse. So I'm most familiar with the crash side of things. We use it at Hyperfish, and I'll dive into a little bit of that for the listeners in a wee while. But in a nutshell, what are the two problems you're trying to solve with both of those products?
Yeah, so when we were looking at building a crash reporting product, we actually were just sort of looking at the challenges we were having in our own business. And we also reflected on the time where my business partner, Jeremy Boyd, and I, we used to work in an IT services company. And what we sort of reflected on was that some developers, ourselves included, we would do things like try and send ourselves emails if there were errors in the code we'd written for customers. And we sort of recognized that that was useful for picking up problems, but it wasn't ultimately that scalable. You didn't get any team management. You'd flood your inboxes. Keep in mind, this was back when, you know, a 10 megabyte inbox was, ultimately, if you had a lot of errors and a lot of them were noise, you had no workflow around it, you had no way of collapsing. So we sort of looked at that and thought, what would be our sort of dream outcome for managing software errors? And so we built Raygun. It sort of functions a little bit like an inbox, and you've got workflow around active and open errors, the resolved errors. Permanently ignored is really, really useful for noisy errors that maybe web crawlers that you don't need to deal with. So we built it a little bit out of a need ourselves. And then obviously it appealed a lot to other developers, which was good. We do all sorts of things like error grouping. So you could have millions of errors, but only have to deal with like 5 or 6 actual bugs. So I sometimes like to explain it like, imagine Jira or something where the bug category just auto-populates with things that are going wrong. And so that's how we kind of came up with that product. We also realized that the industry's moved to a very sort of polyglot environment these days. And so we couldn't just say, we support one language. Mm. That was never going to fly. So we've put a lot of work into making sure the per language stuff works well.
Yeah, ideally, you don't want to be picking a tool based on what languages it supports, right?
Well, there was around the time we started building Raygun, there was a bunch of mobile crash reporting products. And
yeah,
they were good. But, you know, at the end of the day, I spend a bunch of time on planes and things, and I noticed that if I put my apps into airplane mode, that, you know, I'm lucky if even the calculator still works, because just about everything talks to a server. And it was like, I'd say to developers, I'm like, cool, so what happens, how does it catch the errors that are occurring on your backend services? It's like, well, it doesn't. It's like, well, you actually want to get full stack crash reporting, and you don't care whether the part of the backend's written in Go, part of it's in Node, part of it's in .NET, and the front end, you might have JavaScript for the website, you might have a native iOS app as well. You want to get all of that, and you want it in one place. Mm. And so that's where we sort of went with the thinking there. And then last year, we were looking at sort of other things that we needed to know. So Raygun was growing like crazy, and we had this high quality problem, which was having to deal with just performance. We were dealing with so much data that we were frequently finding that we were wondering how long it was taking for some things to load for our customers. And so we built a real user monitoring product, which people are familiar with if they're working usually in larger organizations, because real user monitoring tracks all of the timing for the end users. So it's not a synthetic test. It's not like, hey, we've got 20 data centers that will ping your site, because frankly, that's a data center to data center transaction. Who cares, really? Real users, we collect all of the timings on all of the assets, so the page, the images, the CSS, everything from all of the user interactions on the website. And then we can give you data around that to say, hey, you know what, your site is really slow in these countries, or this browser is currently experiencing an issue that's affecting performance. And you can actually tie that back to the real users as well. So if you sort of go, gosh, you know, this person's having a really tough time, it's one of our customers, we can get in touch with them and actually help try and resolve the problems. So that product's newer, processes a colossal amount of data.
I bet. Yeah.
So, and they work really well together. We've tried to make sure that you don't have to get the whole banana, but they work really well together.
I see. Yeah, no, it reminds me of a number of stories I had when I worked on the Office 365 team. You know, you're only as strong as your weakest link, so to speak. And we'd have folks using 365 in a browser from all over the world, obviously. And sometimes it'd be super fast, and then other people would complain about it being super slow. And you go talk to those folks, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I'm on a 28.8 connection off an oil platform in the Baltic or something like that, right?" And so last mile is super important for user experience. And yeah, like you said, there's only so much testing you can do on your own before real world is important.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting is we work with customers on things. And for we obviously run it against our own platform. And a lot of our time and slowness comes up as child requests, so AJAX calls or third-party scripts that we're loading.
I see.
I went and worked with a customer recently, and they are a huge company. And looking at their stuff, nearly all of their time was lost to the data transfer. And it wasn't that their site was big. It was that they had so much coverage into countries like Africa and India and things like that, where perhaps they were, one, further away from data centers, and two, perhaps the internet infrastructure is not as strong. While our product, we primarily sell it in Europe and America. So we were seeing totally different things. It was really interesting just to try and see how you try and solve these problems for people.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So who would you say these two tools are for? Do you categorize them primarily as developer tools or business tools, or how does that sit?
Yeah, it's a challenge because we can largely talk about the value to almost anyone in a business. I think of them as developer tools because I was always a developer who cared intimately about the experience of my software to end users, and so I think about that a lot. And I love being aware of what's going on. We sell them into ops teams as well, who want, you know, sometimes you've got site reliability engineers. We also have, because we tie everything back to users, we have support teams that use Raygun because they can get a call from a customer, type in their email address and go, oh, I can see you've got this error in here. I'll pass that on to somebody on my team to look at, and they can manage that directly. So I like to say it's the death of receiving the Word document with a screenshot in it that says an error.
We've all been there. Works on my machine, right?
And then you kind of go up the stack to maybe the CTO or the CEO, and you sort of talk about just, let's be honest, software engineering teams are very expensive. You know, we're quite highly paid individuals. And so at the higher levels, they're wanting to make sure they're getting the most out of their team. So they don't want the team to be spending a day trying to even diagnose an error when they could just get it. You've got marketing thinking about cost of acquisition. And if there's errors during trials, that's driving up your cost to acquire. So it's really interesting that we can sort of talk about this product or the whole platform to almost anybody in a business and they understand it. And a sad fact of our industry is, unfortunately, every person is affected by lousy software.
Right.
So they can immediately relate to what we're trying to help solve, which is good.
I think what initially led me to it was this concept of just insight into your software better. It seems like developers really want to build, you know, features and great products, but half the battle is tooling, and knowing what's going on inside your software is a huge part of that, you know, when it's running. And it was the first tool I came across that really, A, was a great experience from a usability point of view and was easy to use and super simple to get set up on, but also gave really interesting insight into what was going on for very little effort. So we drop code snippets into our back end of our API. We use it on a couple of Windows apps as well. And for very little effort, you know, two or three lines of code, or, you know, even a single line of code in some cases, we were getting full stack traces of what was going wrong when an error happened, and any contextual data at the time. And having that insight is incredibly productive for a development team. So they're not sort of flailing around trying to find logs and trying to find what happened and trying to use a divining rod to what the user was up to at a particular point in time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I like to sometimes think of what we're trying to do with the platform as being the digital nervous system for our customers' software. So we started off where we told you where the pain points were, and then performance tracking does that as well, but can also tell you where the pleasure is. You know, this page is doing very well, this thing's going great, and we'll keep going down that route.
Yeah, gotcha. So a couple of scenarios. Let's talk about, I guess, your bog standard scenario, your most popular kind of use case, and then a couple of interesting ones that you've seen more recently or interesting things that you've come across where you thought, wow, I didn't realize people were going to do that.
Yeah, sure. I say first up, the most common way that folks use Raygun is that JavaScript is probably the largest language, only because it's all you get to choose from at the client side. I like to joke that people who tell me JavaScript's good, it's that they're suffering from Stockholm syndrome because they have no choice.
I am 100% on board with that.
but it's big, and then of course people go and put code into the server side. Now we do really well across many languages, Node, Ruby, Python, and .NET. We do have a good number of .NET customers because we originally were obviously selling .NET tools. We had about 6,000 customers back then when we first launched with Raygun, and having them come across means that we we have a good number there. So that's the kind of canonical example, is I put the script in the web page and I put some stuff on the back end. I should qualify, since .NET goes everywhere, that we also support, you know, WPF apps and, you know, Windows services. Anything you want to write in .NET, we can track.
Gotcha.
So that's the common case. The most interesting use case I've come across is a chap was working with an outsourced dev team, and he let us know that he now forces anyone he's paying to write code to use Raygun so that he can log in and actually see the error rates and what's going on. And he uses it as a quality measure for working with third parties.
Hmm.
So, and we've seen that a little bit ourselves with IT services companies. Some of them absolutely run to a product like Raygun because they are trying to sell the quality line. You know, we're not the cheapest, but we do the best work. Here's some facts around it. And other ones just do not want to know about it at all. So this guy, as the client, was like, no, I demand they put it in, and I pay for, you know, he pays for the Raygun account, and they have to put it
gotcha.
In. So that was probably the most interesting use case that I hadn't come across, hadn't even thought about until this guy told me about it.
Wow, that's fascinating. I certainly wouldn't have thought about that. I think, you know, one of the age-old challenges we've had as developers is supporting software that isn't running right next door to you.
Yes.
And, you know, running on your machine on your desk or under your desk or in the server room out the back of the office or something like that. And I think tools like Raygun give you insight into what's happening remotely. It's kind of like, you know, trying to debug the Mars rover from Earth, right? I saw a talk once from the guy who was doing that, and it's an extremely difficult problem. And there are quite a few analogies very similar to that Mars rover from running cloud software, I thought, anyway. So I guess this is only possible with the cloud, right? You're a piece of SaaS software running up in the cloud. Can you give us a little bit of insight into how you run Raygun and sort of what the world of cloud software has allowed you to do in that regard?
Yeah. So we are almost entirely hosted at the moment on Amazon Web Services.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that, to be honest, is just because we were using AWS to host our website a million years ago. And so when we started building out Raygun, we were already on there. So we are actually looking at the moment at moving on to Azure.
Mm.
But the thing is that we can drive down the price of software by saying, hey, look, pick up a monthly subscription. We host all this stuff. We've always been, one of our strengths of the company is we are engineering led. We're engineering to the core. We probably do 10 to 30 deployments a day to production. Mm. And when we were doing the .NET components, we were one of the first companies out there that was doing nightly builds for all of our customers. You could come and get whatever the latest, and that included bug fixes and features. And
gotcha.
People liked that. And so we were thinking, you know, in general terms, how do we capitalize on our ability to move fast? And having a cloud-hosted service really helps us move very quickly. So that was a benefit for us, and it's a benefit to our customers in being able to get all those updates. We do provide an on-premise solution, but the cloud offering is just a better place to be.
Gotcha.
You mentioned, for example, that ease of getting started with one line of code.
Mm.
We don't want people to have to say, okay, I need to go and talk to ops about where I'm going to put my centralized server that's going to receive my error logs, and then I can start looking at instrumenting my code. Like, that's a crappy experience. We want people to have a really, really good experience. So in a lot of ways, it's not that you could never have done what we're doing without the cloud, but it would be a downright painful experience. And because it's so involved, we'd probably be saying, you know what, we can only sell these products to maybe, you know, a certain portion, the higher end of the market, for wanting to go through all of those hoops. And I like the fact that we have a broad range of customers, from indie software developers building something on the side or a home project, right through to the Fortune 50 organizations that are rolling this out. And the cloud lets us support both those customers in that full gambit seamlessly. And that's the real strength for a business and for us on the coding level.
Have you found people's reluctance to using a service like yours, but that's cloud-based? Do you get a lot of pushback from sort of the old, the on-prem guys that are either on-prem because they don't have a choice for whatever reason,
yeah,
maybe regulatory or something like that, or just like being on-prem? Do you get much pushback from those folks? And you mentioned you had an on-prem version of your product. Is it popular? And what are some of the common things that you get pushback from that either folks eventually get over and use your cloud service or are stuck on-prem and need to go the on-prem route?
Yeah, so the interesting thing I always find with that is we get a handful of people ask. The thing I've never understood when people contact us about on-prem is they kind of think, they look at the subscription pricing and they go, okay, so it's got to be maybe a little bit more than that. And it's like, no, you make our life kind of miserable.
It's a much, much bigger deal supporting an on-prem piece of software.
And it's interesting that, to be honest, once you sort of say to somebody, hey, the price actually, you know, let's add several orders of magnitude to the price, suddenly the cloud doesn't sound so bad.
So
we have found that. So in terms of general popularity, no, the on-prem thing is not popular. Even though we make substantial revenue from an on-prem version, we don't really want to be having to maintain a lot of on-prem versions with customers. So we actually work very hard to drive them towards the cloud. It's just that it is a shrinking minority of organizations that just say straight up, we have to be on-prem. Mm. Even then, however, you've got two sets of on-prem. You've got the people that have their own data center, their own people running them, that's not a fun place to be. You get the people who say, well, you know, we just want to basically have our own Azure instances that our ops team control own AWS. And under that, those scenarios where we can say to them, hey, we're a trusted advisor to you around this product, you know, in terms of managing the updates and that, we can actually work quite seamlessly on those. So they're not so bad. I'm not anti, you know, the idea of on-prem, where on-prem is actually like private cloud.
I see.
That's a lot easier to work with. And now that this wasn't the same way it was 5 years ago, but now that the cloud is, we've got data centers in just about every country, that works really well. Because often that was the regulatory side. It wasn't so much that it had to be only in their data center. It was usually that it had to be in their country.
Data sovereignty issues and so forth.
Mm. Yeah. And so that's largely been overcome, which is nice.
Gotcha. I guess that sort of leads on to another interesting question about, you know, obviously you mentioned AWS, so that's currently what you're built on. How about deployment? Do you take advantage of those multiple data centers right now? And is that something you're looking to do more of with things like you mentioned Azure, potentially in your future around, say, the Azure government cloud for, you know, government customers or highly, you know, regulated customers and things like that? Is that something that pops up on your radar from time to time?
It absolutely does. Definitely pops up. In terms of deployment, we do operate parts of the service across different data centers, but we are fairly heavily in the US data centers at the moment. We are looking at improving the story around that. That is something we're actively working on. So there is that. We, in terms of the multi-cloud, as in, hey, would you keep some servers, say, in AWS versus Azure? Mm-hmm. We haven't been so concerned about that, to be honest. It's more likely that we just sort of will all in on the Azure offering.
Gotcha.
So that's more how we look at it.
Interesting. Okay. And so I take it you run sort of on IaaS right now with a bunch of VMs and things like that. It sounds like on the AWS side, that might be what you're doing. Is that the case?
Yeah. So we don't typically make use of very many of the platform features. So we haven't got any real vendor lock-in. So, for example, we haven't used the queuing service they have. We just run RabbitMQ on our own VMs. Part of the reason for that, however, is because we didn't want to be locked in. We want to be able to move. And secondly, is that at the volumes of data that we deal with, you are typically talking about numbers that even when you're paying fractions of a penny per message or something, it actually costs us a lot more. We're very performance orientated in our engineering team. And so we've found that those things often don't scale. A common comment people will make is, oh, sure, but if you went and talked to them, they'd do you a deal. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's cool. Or I could just, that's me having to do more work to lock in. I'd rather.
Yeah, yeah.
So we don't do that. And that's fine.
I guess that makes sense when I sort of see a tipping point for people where, A, they're technically savvy enough to do it themselves, but also, as you mentioned, like at the volume and scale, at a certain point, it becomes advantageous to have, you know, full control from almost from metal to the top of the stack, and being able to eke out performance at each of those points can be cost effective, I guess, is what you're also seeing there.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that we're not losing. It's not like we're saying we're in the cloud, but we're treating it like it's a server just sitting in our own rack, because what we still make use of is things like the elastic load balancers, auto scale out groups, things like that, where we don't have to leave idle servers waiting for that load. So we do get to take advantage, but that's just a cloud benefit, right? And you get that with all of the providers.
Gotcha. And I think maybe in a wee while after you've made your transition to Azure, I'd love to invite you back to talk about that, because it's something that we don't talk to a lot of folks about, actually. We haven't seen ISVs that have made the transition and talk to them. So it'd be interesting to if you blog about it or are willing to come and talk to people about it, then we'd love to have you back to talk about that, because that's something that's really interesting to us.
Yeah, no, I'd love to come back and have a chat about that. Just as a side note for listeners who might be interested, our tech stack, we have basically about a 50-50 split between Linux boxes and Windows boxes as well. The core product is written in ASP.NET, and so we run that on Windows. And one thing we're quite excited about is the improved containerization support coming in Server 2016 for that. So I'm kind of hoping that we can have a play around with that, and that might actually even make it easier in terms of our being able to move later on.
Yeah, certainly. I think I've said this before in a couple of shows that listeners might have heard before, but I think there's this wave coming around containerization for Windows developers that they're not fully aware of yet.
Yeah.
And it'll really open people's eyes and minds up to how to build and deploy and manage applications. So I'm very much looking forward to the Windows container wave that's coming, and especially around the work they're doing with .NET Core and portability of that, and it'll make running Windows apps a whole different kettle of fish.
Yeah, we're looking quite heavily at .NET Core in particular around our API nodes. So at the moment, our API nodes are running using Node.js because our API is pretty dumb, to be honest. All it does is take in the data, check a couple of things, and then pass it off for processing.
I see.
And my business partner has sort of prototyped out. It's been fascinating. I mean, admittedly, we probably could have done things better with Node, but to put it in context, on the size instance that we run at the moment with Node, we can process about 800 to 1,000 requests a second, and then we have a whole farm of those nodes. And with his early .NET Core version, which does have some other optimizations, obviously, while he's been working on it, but he's handling about 40,000 requests per second on the same size box with .NET
Core. Wow.
So that's looking like it's going to be a big win for us.
That's really interesting. So is he doing that on Linux or on Windows with the .NET Core stuff? Is that like literally the same size box as the way you're running Node?
Literally the same size box, also Linux. Yeah, so Node's running on Linux for the API. Effectively, you can kind of understand that because we have this fairly big autoscale groups around the API, we look at it in terms of going, hey, we really like to have those nodes running Linux. They're dumb boxes. They're not really doing much, but they are essential. Yep. So if we've got to have 50 of them, we really want to make sure that they cost as little as possible to run. And that's why we didn't want to say, well, we could put .NET proper on here with IIS, but frankly, we're not doing anything magical. So .NET Core giving us the ability to use Linux is a big win on our sort of cost to serve.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think this is it's an interesting development because it's going to force that choice, right? Right now, you're a .NET shop, you deploy on Windows. But with .NET Core, it's going to be an interesting question for people about, you know, not just what language am I using and whether I'm using .NET, but now also what are my deployment options around the OS that I do that on? And the choices that are available to them are obviously a bit more broad than they were not so long ago.
Absolutely.
So how about, you know, a little bit more about how you guys are built and run? Do you use Docker today? You mentioned Node, deploying straight out onto Linux boxes for the sort of the API shim layer in your application. You mentioned Rabbit. What are some of the other sort of components that you use behind the scenes to run a service of the scale that you guys are at?
We're not really using Docker and Angular at the moment, partly because we wanted to wait until we can properly containerize everything. And so we're hanging out on Windows Server 2016 to help with that. I know there is a bit of a story previously, but we've got other other fish to fry.
Other priorities, yep.
In our tech stack, we've also got Redis in there. We've got Postgres. We've got MySQL. We've got Elasticsearch. We've got, we do have SQL Server in there for effectively a lot of the admin reporting functions that we use to basically more reporting around the user behaviors and the financial reporting. I end up looking at that system quite a bit. To Mary Max here, we've got Rabbit in there. We wrote our own storage subsystem, and that's designed to back off any sort of block storage. So at the moment, obviously, it's S3 inside of AWS, but that's helped us where we can do things like, you know, we can press the blocks together, we get fast indexing, and we've that's been a big win for us on being able to scale the platform as part of the secret sauce. So
gotcha. So some abstraction away from your underlying storage provider and making some optimizations in how you do that.
Yeah, also being able to handle the sheer volume of things come in and make sure that we can store all of them. So one of the big selling points we have is that we have just this colossal amount of data. So we're not just storing a time series chart. We can give you all of the data. So, you know, if you need to go through and look at all of the custom data attached to error reports, or you want to look at all of the session details, we collect all of that for you. Mm-hmm. And of course, being able to do that cost effectively is quite a challenge. And so that's how we solved that.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a little dive into how we're using it. We're obviously not in production yet. We haven't launched, but we're using Raygun across our application stack. Our backend is all in Node, running in Docker up in Azure. And we have some front-end applications, obviously. You know, web application is one of them. You know, you mentioned your only choice is JavaScript. But we also have a Windows service that we're going to deploy on premises with customers. And we also have a trial application, which is a WPF app that people run. And we use Raygun on each of those components, all four of those major pieces. It's been great for us. I mean, we obviously get the stack on the Node side from this, you know, server monitoring perspective, but we're using it in our client applications as well. And, you know, that's even more important because that's one of those, you can't log into the boxes and go take a look at what's happening. And so Raygun collecting environment information about, you know, what version of Windows are they using? How much memory does it have? What are the CPU types and things like that to give us more information about what's happening in the environment is super important to us because we can't sit there and watch what the customer is doing, sitting alongside them or logging into their box and debugging it. So anything that we can do to know what happened, what went wrong, everything around the context of what happened at the time is very, very useful to us to go see. And it's worth, in my experience, it pays exponentially for itself down the line when problems start happening and you've got no visibility into it and your customers are having a terrible experience. You want to be in a position to knowing more about what's going on, and doing the work up front is certainly worth it in my experience. So so far, so good. I guess, are we doing it right? I guess is my big question.
Wow. That was, to be honest.
I guess you're biased, so yeah.
I am a bit biased, but I would just say, I mean, that it comes back to the point, and I don't want to be overly salesy, but, you know, one of the things we picked up early on when we first launched Raygun was that we were getting people who had just started using it contacting us and saying, hey, guys, I want to do a case study for you. And when we were getting that, you know, it was like, oh, you know, we must be doing something right here for developers. And so that was heartening. And then obviously the growth of the company and the product, you don't get that without actually providing something of value to people.
No, absolutely.
You know, we don't have an army of salespeople that have tried to get this in there. And I think as developers, we don't particularly like having to spend too long trying to debug things that aren't working. We would rather work on interesting new problems, and we try and make sure that they can focus on those new problems. Your experience is great to hear, and I love hearing them.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth pointing out that crash reporting in particular is not a logging solution for your applications, right? It's not it's not a log file solution. It's a when something happens, you want to capture that and surface it. And there's a whole alerting side to it as well that fascinates me, that, you know, when something goes wrong in your app, rather than sort of errors going into a log file never to be seen again, there's a big piece of the product is around integrations with other systems and telling people about what's going on and when it happens, right?
Yeah, we integrate with about 30 different systems. So they're broadly broken into areas like chat, so Slack, HipChat, those sorts of things. We've got issue trackers like GitHub issues, Jira, UTrack. Then there's alerting products. So we do have alerting built in a simple way, but we can hook in with VictorOps and PagerDuty so they can do threshold stuff. We've got some webhooks in there if you want to do your own custom bits and pieces. And then source control integration so that we can track deployment commits and things like that. So we can actually show you alongside your errors, hey, look, this probably occurred because of this commit, that sort of stuff. The thing we've found really, really useful is the chat stuff. So there's this rise of this term called chat ops, you know, which is the bots pumping data into a Slack channel. And so we have a Raygun errors in our own Slack that the engineering team are in. And where that's useful is you can see those things pop by. And then when something really out of the ordinary happens, you know, somebody will run there, you know, hey, you know, at here, doesn't that look a little stranger than normal? Like maybe we need to go look at that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's proved really powerful. At one point, we'll probably write a blog post about all the different terms. So we get people that say they got a ray gun. We got another company that says they get their ray rays. And then about 2 weeks ago, I heard from one company where they said, you know what we really need? We need a ray gun for HR that doesn't alert when there's an HR violation.
Now, there's a $1 million idea, isn't there? Brilliant. Yeah, I guess first to get a ray gun for HR wins for sure. That's it would be, you know, I don't want to go into all the detail, but it would be firing every 5 minutes in our office. We're, yes, we're very relaxed about that stuff. So why do you think ray gun's doing so well? I mean, this is not a new problem, so to speak. I mean, it might be a new solution to the problem, but you know, we've had this issue of crash reporting and knowing what users are doing in their applications for a very long time. But it seems like now people care about the experience users are having. And so what do you think, if you distilled it down to one or two things that you think that, you know, the reasons why Raygun has taken off and your products in these space, what would you say that those two things are?
That's it's a really good question. I think that the reason that it's becoming more important and people are focusing more on user experience is multifaceted. We've spent so long just innovating as fast as we can that our industry does have a pretty bad track record for on the quality front. And so we're trying to resolve that now. And I think the big driver for that is the competitiveness in our industry has just gone up and up and up. So you don't go to google.com and get a 500 error. You don't go to Facebook and get an error. But these are companies that have invested millions of dollars into trying to make sure they deliver that quality because they're operating at a scale where they know they lose serious money if they're not available. Now, what happens with that, of course, is you start getting this slow turn of the end users where they start to think you're doing a bad job if you're ever doing poorly. And so where I see our offering and the space is that companies are starting to say, we need to do better. We don't have $50 million, $100 million, whatever, to spend on resilient, robust software. So what can we go and put in there to make sure that we can improve the quality? And so that's where we step in and we can say, hey, we can provide you this and it'll give you a piece of the platform. It'll give you enough to raise your quality bar, a good margin, make your customers happier. So I think that's part of the driver. I think you hit the nail on the head around the issues where you were talking about, you know, the desktop users where you can't access the logs. And I think that's why we saw crash reporting sort of appear in a big way for mobile, was that you can't access the user's phone. And even if you knew who the user was, they're not going to even know how to get to a log file.
Right.
So that was really hard. And I think it was kind of sad that we saw these companies all appear, only do mobile, all get acquired. And it's like, man, this is a space that we can do so much more in. We can change the quality profile of all software if you just take a bigger picture to it. So I think there are some of the drivers in there. Yeah, the quality is becoming important. It's the same. It's following a similar trend, if you will, to around like the UI of things, right? So, you know, started about 10 years ago now, where everybody suddenly went, you know what, design is actually really important. You know,
right.
And it was kind of like, well, duh, of course. Yeah. So, but it took our industry a pretty long time to latch on to that idea. And I think now we're starting to see that around quality.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. It's, I think you mentioned earlier on, like trying to do this on your own before was prohibitively painful. And now with cloud and services like yourselves available, you're signing up for a service that does all of this stuff for relatively not a lot of money, and the benefits that it adds to your software is, you know, it just wasn't possible in the past. We're using a bunch of different services, Raygun of one of them, obviously, but a bunch of other things, and doing that on our own would have been extremely expensive and probably cost prohibitive and time prohibitive.
Yeah, I'm always like roll my eyes. We occasionally get people who sort of will say, I'm just going to build it myself. And I'm like, really? Okay, that seems like the dumbest idea ever, because it's going to cost you $50. You're a highly paid software engineer. You're going to try and build something better than a dedicated platform that's been updated nonstop by a big team of people. Maybe that'll be the next one, trying to get developers to think in terms of actual economics.
Yeah, maybe.
But, yeah, it's, a, well, it's an odd one.
From a technical management position, you know, it's a no-brainer. You know, I sat down with one of my guys the other day, and we were talking about hosted Postgres versus doing it ourselves. And we were having a problem with spinning up a new instance ourselves, and we weren't getting the perf we wanted and things like that. And I was like, look, why don't we just buy a hosted version of this thing, have somebody run it who knows how to run it, that we get the perf and the features that we want out of it. And he's like, well, but you know, that's going to cost us a bunch. And I was like, a whole lot less than you losing productivity for a couple of weeks figuring this out yourself. So
absolutely,
and you, the cost benefit of services like that is quite different now.
Yeah. Plus, I always think back to, you know, we all have the privilege of coming into work and working on something we love because our customers pay for our product, right? No one's going to sit down with your product and go, well, I picked this because I just had a hunch that they were self-hosting Postgres behind the scenes. Yeah, and you guys being able to focus on the actual feature that deliverables the customers care about is super important. I think about it that way as well, as the economic term is, if it takes them 2 weeks, couldn't he build something customer-facing?
Exactly. So. What's the opportunity cost, right?
Indeed.
So where to next for Raygun? I mean, you mentioned some platform things you've got coming up on the radar, but Pulse and the crash reporting product, your things for the foreseeable future? Obviously, I don't want to, you know, have you give away any secrets on the show or anything like that, but can we expect more from Raygun in terms of new products and things like that over the next wee while?
Absolutely. So we do have crash reporting. We launched Pulse as real user monitoring for the web last year. Mm-hmm. We've just announced Pulse for mobile going into beta this week. So that's
exciting.
All of that.
Yeah.
Next week, we will be going into beta for what we call Pulse Insights, which is a capability for the web version. And what that does is it runs, if you're aware of Google Page Speed or YSlow, so it's doing analysis on the page. So rather than just the timings from the users, we then go back to those URLs and analyze them. And the nice thing about that is that we can start saying, hey, there's this rule violation. Maybe it's like you're not gzipping.
Mm.
Oh, and it affects all of these assets so that you can say, oh, well, if I fix this one thing, it's going to have a wide impact on our site. Our big thing is that we like our tools to try and give you actionable things to do to make things better.
Gotcha.
And so coupling that onto Pulse is a big one. And then I wouldn't be surprised if we had a third major pillar to the platform before the end of the year.
Exciting.
And I mostly wouldn't be surprised because I know it's happening.
Yeah. That doesn't sound awfully vague. Yeah. Well, we will obviously keep our eyes peeled and potentially get you back to talk about that when the time is right. But
I'd love it, CJ. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for coming on the show. I guess, where should people go to find out more?
So we are live on the internet at raygun.com, raygun.com. If people wanted to touch base with me directly, they can either contact us through the site, or I am on Twitter as TraskJD, TraskJD, and happy to to answer any questions people might have.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. I think I've mentioned Raygun as a couple of, we do picks on the show each week of just interesting things that we've come across and that we're learning more about. And I've mentioned Raygun in the past, so our listeners may be familiar with my fascination for your products. So I appreciate you coming on the show and talking a little bit more about obviously what it does, how you do it, what you're finding interesting along the way, and talking about building cloud software. So we really appreciate it. And thanks again, JD.
It's been a real privilege. Thanks.
Cheers.
Send us a tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Air by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.